Hi, this is Kurt. People say that comedy is harder to pull off than drama, and there is some truth to that. Creating something revealing and poignant and surprising that also makes people laugh not only takes skill, but success or failure is pretty unequivocal and instantaneous. Here's a playlist of some of my favorite funny people to come through Studio 360 over the last few years, and it starts with a genuine legend. Enjoy. Four years ago, when Mel Brooks was honored as an official national treasure at the Kennedy Center, President Obama described him this way.
As you can tell, he was born to entertain. Or as Mel Brooks explains it, look at Jewish history. Unrelieved lamenting would be intolerable. So every 10 Jews, God designed one to be crazy and amuse the others.
And now 2013 brings still more honors for Mel Brooks. In June, he'll receive the American Film Institute's Lifetime Achievement Award. In May, PBS premieres its American Masters documentary, Mel Brooks, Make a Noise. As if I needed an excuse to want to sit down for this interview, Mel Brooks, welcome to Studio 360.
Kurt Anderson.
We often ask people on this show, was there a moment when you decided, my life has changed because I've seen this thing or read this book or whatever? I understand yours was really like that when you saw Anything Goes on Broadway.
Well, I was about 9 years old, and my Uncle Joe comes over and says, Uncle Joe drove a cab. If you saw a cab coming down the street without a driver, that was Joe. He was incredibly short. So Joe used to take these doormen to various theaters on Broadway, the ones that lived in Brooklyn, back to Brooklyn at night when he was rounding up his night. And he would just pick up these guys from, one of them was at the Alvin Theater, and told him he would get him some tickets to this new show that was opening called Anything Goes. So Joe took me to see, I think it was like the third or fourth night of the run of Anything Goes.
1934 then.
Yeah, yeah. No microphones. We were sitting in the last two seats in the last row of the balcony. And I thought that Ethel Merman was still a little too loud.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes. Good authors.
Had you ever seen a show before?
I'd never seen a show, and I think I went a little crazy. I think I went nuts. I kept singing all the songs all through the night. I love the ballads as well as, you know, You're the Top. And the spirit, the joy that emanated from that stage that filled the audience with craziness and love and happiness and comedy and bounce. And I said, this is it, you know. I knew then that I would not be one of the citizens who lived at 365 South 3rd Street to enter the Garment Center. I didn't want to be a shipping clerk. It's one life, and I'm going to live it on that stage with footlights and with a big orchestra in the pit and singing my heart out, you know.
And then you get back from the war and start writing for television at this extraordinary crucible, and you spend a decade doing that. And was it as a writer for Sid Caesar with Carl Reiner that you started developing The 2,000-Year-Old Man?
That wasn't my doing. That was Carl Reiner. He had this wire recorder, which was brand new in 1951 or two. And he'd walk over to me and he'd say, I understand that, sir, that you're actually 2,000 years old. And
you lived, of course, during the time of Christ.
I knew him, a nice boy.
You knew Jesus?
Oh, he's a nice, lovely, thin, a nice little boy.
Yes. I mean, is he as
wore sandals.
He wore sandals.
Wore sandals.
Very much as he's pictured today in the motion pictures that we see of him.
Well, they made a travesty of it.
Well, didn't Jesus behave that way?
No, he was quiet, a quiet lad.
He didn't do that?
No, he came in the store. He never bought anything.
That's The 2,000-Year-Old Man. In the new PBS documentary about you, Rob Reiner says that his father, Carl Reiner, he had this way of painting you into a corner in that bit, and that you are at your best when you're painted into the corner. You agree with that?
I say something, and then Carl challenges me on it, and I know I'm trapped. And, you know, he knew I would come up with something, and he always pushed me into a corner, you know.
Really? And so you really, over the years, improvised that bit into all of its many versions?
Well, the first two albums were almost completely ad-lib. I never knew what the question was going to be, and I never knew what answer I would come up with. But after that, when we became kind of known for it, and we were put on things like the Ed Sullivan Show or the Hollywood Palace, we were only given 4 or 5 minutes to do our act and get our laughs. So we wrote down what we wanted to do.
Earlier in the show, we heard from Billy Crystal, who called that routine the comedian's Bible. Why do you think that is? What was it that indoctrinated so many funny people that this was part of their catechism?
I think because it captured an immigrant sensibility. It was the quickness of the Jewish immigrant who got off the boat and kind of made a living on the Lower East Side, opened a store, put herrings in a barrel and sold them. Maybe the second week he was in America, the 2,000-year-old man kind of captures some of the joie de vivre, the spirit of making a life for the immigrant.
Yeah. I became familiar with you through seeing and listening to that album and then seeing you on The Tonight Show, watching it with my father as a little kid. And I had never seen my small-town Nebraska lawyer father laugh at anything as hard as he laughed at you every time you were on television. And
isn't that nice? He was a lawyer, a small-town lawyer in Omaha?
Yep.
That's beautiful because that's Johnny Carson, who was interviewing me,
yes,
was from Omaha.
Yes. Well, Johnny Carson, whom my mother hired to perform magic at the University of Nebraska Student Union. So there you go.
Oh, my God. That's incredible. Wow.
Before we talk some more, let's hear a little of Springtime for Hitler from 1968.
Germany was having trouble. What a sad, sad story. Needed a new leader to restore its former glory. Where, oh, where was he?
Where could that man be?
We looked around and then we found the man for you and me. And now it's
springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay.
Now, as I listen to that, I mean, of course, it's now that I've been around for a while. It's amazing that that's only 23 years after the war. I wonder if one of the reasons it did work is because of the 1968 craziness. The world was being turned upside down and conventionalism was being thrown out the window.
I was very lucky. Things got restricted and constricted later. I couldn't do Blazing Saddles today.
That's interesting.
I couldn't do it. I couldn't use the N-word so freely and furiously as I use it in Blazing Saddles.
That's certainly true.
I don't think I could even punch a horse, let alone a little old lady. It was, somewhere between 65 and 75 was a time of great comic freedom in America. And I think this new American Masters that you'll see on PBS May 20th at 9 p.m., does capture a lot of that.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any other movie ever made that was as, well, the nice word would be bold.
Yeah.
The real word would be an execrable taste, you know.
Well, let's play a scene from that film where the new black sheriff, played by Cleavon Little, is
You're
is
being
insulted,
dangerous, Kurt.
Insulted by a townsperson and then comforted by his pal, played by Gene Wilder.
Good morning, ma'am. And isn't it a lovely morning? Up yours.
Oh, Jesus.
What did you expect? Welcome, Sonny. You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. The common clay of the New West. You know. Morons.
That was a good moment.
It was a great moment. And Gene Wilder had become your pal and kind of muse and collaborator in The Producers. What was it about him and you together that worked so well, do you think?
I don't know. We were on the kind of, you know, the same frequency, the same wavelength. And we knew that, you know, comedy didn't work without humanity. We didn't care about the comedy that said, so my wife said, you never take me anywhere. Take me to a new place. I want to see new places. So I took her to the kitchen, you know, yeah. Which is funny, you know, as Henny Youngman. But that was not the comedy that thrilled or excited us. The comedy that excited us were what was actually happening to people. And if we could point it out in a humorous way, we knew that they'd get it. We were not the comedy of privilege, and we were not the comedy of stand-up and one-liners. Uh-huh. We were what I learned from Sid Caesar. We were the comedy, I think, without being too, you know, puffy, or with humanity. I mean, we just cared about people.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky. Richard Pryor was supposed to play the black guy. And Warner Brothers said, no, he's a druggie. We know he takes drugs, and we know this, and we know too much about him. And this was before Richard Pryor became a big star. They were so stupid. Anyway, I conducted auditions, and I couldn't find anybody close to Richard Pryor, who was really maybe the best, outside of Sid Caesar, the best comedian that ever lived.
Yep, absolutely agree with you.
And Richie was with me, and you know, Richie said the most weird thing. When we saw a Cleavon Little, Richie said, this guy's laid back, he knows what he's doing. And he says, let me tell you, you may have gotten lucky, you may have taken a good bounce here, Mel. I said, what do you mean? He said, he's black. I'm kind of coffee colored. You say to black sheriff, you want to scare the shit out of those people. You're really bringing a real black man. And he was not only black, he was beautiful. He was the handsomest guy I ever saw in my life.
I was amazed as I was doing research for this that Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles both came out in 1974, which is kind of, I thought it must have been a mistake.
You know, it's just an accident because it was like the year in Variety. Here I was amazing. I was looking at it. 365 South 3rd Street between Hooper and Keep, you know, on the top floor and in the back, not even in the front of the building, $16 a month. The baby of a family who lost a father when I was 2 years old. My mother had to do the diapers, had to cook and clean and scrub linoleum floors. And there I was, 1-2.
Yep.
1-2 in Variety.
The hottest hand in Hollywood.
Yes. I mean, it was just amazing.
So you had these amazing string of successes in the 70s and into the 80s. Did you feel when you had less commercial films in the 90s, less successful ones, did you think like, what's going on? Have I lost it?
Exactly. And I said, have I lost it? And the answer came to me kind of in a dream. Yes, you have. You have lost it. Go away. Go back to being a shipping clerk for the Abilene Blouse and Dress Company.
So you've had, kind of amazingly, these several separate big careers, TV writer, comedy personality, movie director, movie producer, Broadway, auteur. If you had to, like, attribute it to what percentage talent, what percentage tenacity, ambition, and what percentage luck?
That's good. You're right. You know, it's, you know, the easiest thing to tell you, and probably the most correct, break it into thirds and you got it. Just what you said.
Yeah?
What did you say?
Talent, tenacity and ambition, and luck.
Okay. The first would be tenacity and ambition. Coming really out of the gutters, literally out of the gutters, out of the streets of Brooklyn. You know, fighting to make my way in a world that I was not really, that we were disenfranchised. We were not part of it. We were kind of, you know, the tenement dwellers, the poor of the world, you know, and mm-hmm. We didn't make decisions about the world. We just try to keep our heads above water. So tenacity and ambition, absolutely. The baby of three other brothers, you know, fighting for my, you know.
Which, by the way, as a youngest child myself, I see in you the super version of the youngest child. This, you know, you have all the character, it seems to me, of a youngest kid.
Yes, I do. But I also had – my father died when I was only 2, and my mother – I didn't learn to walk till I was 5. I was always in her arms. She always loved me. She always felt this warmth and this – the sadness that here's this baby not growing up with a daddy. And, you know, and so she tried to give me daddy and her mommy love, you know. And and she really loved me. And, you know, and I think if you got your mother's love and you got your mother's attention and love – you can't go wrong.
Right.
And I had an older brother, my brother Irving, who acted as a surrogate father. I'm there. I'm saying, how many people signed a declaration? I can't do this homework. I cannot do this homework. I got three. I think I've got Jefferson, Franklin, and Washington signed. He said, no, you're wrong. Washington never signed that. So I said, who the hell? They want 20 names at signing the Declaration of Independence. Oh, my God. You know, and Irving said, well, where do you play, you know, punch ball? I said, on Marcy Avenue. He said, where's the signer? He said, where do we live? I said, on Hooper. Where's the signer? Where's the,
that's great.
Where's the street that you go, where your school, PS90? I said, use. There's a signer. Where's the library? Rodney. There's a signer. You know, it went on and on. I said,
that's
oh, my
fantastic.
God, I got it. I got it. That's why they call it Williamsburg. All the streets are signers of the Declaration. I was living in it. You know, that was my homework. And Irving, he saved my life, you know.
Mel Brooks.
I want to thank you so much. This was such a pleasure for me.
It was good for me, too.
The PBS American Masters documentary, Mel Brooks, Make a Noise, premieres nationwide on May 20th.
May 20th. Good, good. I'm glad you said it.
Yes.
Because it's not nice if I just keep pushing it.
There you go.
But they had a great subject. They had me in my life. I mean, they were working with gold. What can I tell you?
Mel Brooks, thanks a lot.
Kurt Anderson, I can't thank you enough, so no thanks.
Good.
No. It was easy. That's the best thing I could say about anything. I could say this was easy.
I agree.
It was great.
Excellent.
Okay.
Okay.
Kurt, keep in touch. Don't be strange.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care.
See ya.
All right, see ya.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I met Mel Brooks for the first time 35 years ago on my first job out of college working for Gene Shalit at the Today Show. When I brought up that encounter, Mel Brooks told me how Shalit is the reason that he has a career in film, in his opinion. You can hear that story at studio360.org. For a comedian, getting a job on Saturday Night Live is a big deal. Really, the big deal.
Featuring Jenny Slate.
Jenny Slate got that job at age 27, 5 years ago. And in her very first appearance, she made one of the worst mistakes you can make on live TV.
You freaking just threw an ashtray full of butts at my head. You know what? You stood up for yourself, and I f***ing love you for that.
You're in my heart, babe. You're in my heart.
Jenny Slate lasted only a year on SNL, but shortly after, she made a little stop-motion video with her filmmaker husband. It was about a character she called Marcel the Shell. It got more than 23 million views on YouTube and launched a best-selling children's book besides. Since then, Slate has been on TV shows like Parks and Recreation, House of Lies, Kroll Show, Bob's Burgers, and Married. And she starred in this summer's Kickstarter-funded Sundance-launched romantic comedy called Obvious Child. She plays a comedian who's trying to sort out the big issues of adulthood.
Kate has HPV, the kind of HPV where you get warts on your stuff and ovarian cancer. There's a lot of other stuff I could say, but I'm a lady. And then she dies of cancer and you're stuck with the bill, so...
I just wanted to apologize for the voicemail that I just left on your voicemail. And I also wanted to say, psych!
Jenny Slate, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
So your involvement in Obvious Child goes back 5 years, which is half your adult lifetime by my reckoning. There was a short film before this movie occurred.
Yeah. 2009 was when we made the short film. It was written before I knew Gillian Robespierre, the writer and director. And we had a friend in common, and she came, and she ended up seeing me do stand-up and asked me to do the short.
And so your career has gone pretty gangbusters since then. Why did you stick with it? Why didn't you say, that was when I was young, that was a short film, I don't want to do this?
Well, it seems like that's the exact reason probably to stick with it. You know, she was somebody that I knew and I trusted, and she was smart, and the subject matter was dealt with in a way that I had just never seen or even heard of before.
Right.
And in a way, you put there's a lot of risk because you care about it, and kind of like not a lot of risk because when you make such a small indie film, like for very, very low budget, people might never see it.
Yeah. Well, but they're seeing this, and I want to talk about the subject matter. In addition to being a funny movie, your character decides to have an abortion after getting pregnant, which I think gets it extra praise from people on that side of the reproductive rights barricades, right? Apart from liking the movie and thinking it was important, I mean, did you think it was important to sort of in a kind of political way to show this character who decides to do that?
You know, now looking at it, after we finished it, I think that. I understand that. But going into it, my concern was, is it entertaining and is it useful?
Uh-huh.
And if it's, you know, like...
Useful?
Just, yeah. Is it useful to me? Do I get something out of it? And
not useful to the greater good?
Not really. I don't think of myself on such, like, grand terms. Or that's what I thought.
Yeah.
And then after we made the movie, I realized how many people were saying, like, there hasn't been anything like this before.
At your fancy prep school, Milton Academy, you were valedictorian. You were on the speech team. I don't know if that is a good thing or a bad thing.
Both.
You were class president. You went on to study literature at the Ivy League school, Columbia University.
Yeah.
When and how and where did comedy enter into this equation?
Always.
You were funny in high school?
I think I was funny at camp and then just trying to like keep my head down in high school.
Uh-huh.
What I realize now is that I just wanted to be an adult. I just wanted to be an adult woman. And growing up, I think the first glimpse I got of Lily Tomlin and Madeleine Kahn especially and Carol Burnett and Gilda Radner, I just wanted to be that, which also meant adult woman.
Right. But were you thinking by the time you got to college, like, this is my career path. I'm not going to go to law school. I'm not going to, like, become a PhD?
Yeah. Oh, I always knew I would just do undergrad.
Uh-huh.
But my parents are both artists.
Right.
So it wasn't weird for
them. Your father's a poet and your mother's a potter.
Yeah. She's a raku potter.
So they were okay with you just being the groovy artist that you became?
I'm many things. Yeah, no, they were fine with it. Yeah. I also have two sisters who are, like, you know, very responsible. So I was always a little bit of, like, the squiggle, you know.
As the middle child, you mean?
Yeah. We got these VHS tapes of SNL, like, the first 20 years or something. And I remember watching Gilda Radner and asking my dad about her. And he was like, yeah, you can do that.
And you went out and did stand-up starting when?
When I graduated from college in 2004, my best friend Gabe Liedman, who plays Joey in Obvious Child, he and I started as a duo. We tried to be in a sketch group with our other friends from Columbia, and then they all went to grad school. And it was just us.
Yeah. When you've done stand-up, are you a raunchy confessional comedian like your character, Donna, in
I think
Obvious
so.
Child? Yeah?
But Donna, really, she doesn't have the right type of boundaries, and...
So she's the extreme, unwell brought up version of you.
My subject matter is similar, although I wouldn't like talk about my husband in that way. I would never make fun of him, ever, or really be hurtful. Like, even if sometimes people are talking during my sets, I remember having to ask a man to be quiet and just saying, like, sir, can you please shut up? I'm really sorry, you know? And he was like, oh, sorry, you know? And he was just like a giant man. And then I also was just like, and please don't kill me. But also, like, beautiful muscles, you know? But that's as close as I'll go to, you know, being aggressive.
So you were on Saturday Night Live for a season. And you said since that you didn't find it a very good fit. What do you mean by that? How so?
I'm just, I guess, too freeform, and I don't react well when there's a lot of fear in the environment for a reason that I don't understand.
And when you say fear, just because there are places, and we all know them, and some of us have worked in them, where that's part of the culture, and that was true there for you?
For me, I mean... You know, there's like the fear of Tuesday night writing night. Like, will people accept you? There's the fear of the table read. Like, and it's just, I don't know. I guess sometimes I felt myself being like, well, one day we're all going to be 85. I hope we're proud of the way we're acting here.
Yeah.
I don't think we are.
Yeah.
You know, and essentially we all just poop in a toilet. Like, why are we acting like this is the biggest thing in the world? We're not, we're just trying to be entertaining. Like, what happened to the beating heart of it? I don't know. I just felt very incorrect. I felt very bad about myself.
Uh-huh. And you grew up being amazed by Gilda Radner on Saturday Night Live. Obviously, Saturday Night Live is a thing for comic actors and comedians. Like, that's the place where
it can
be your launching pad to movie career, TV career. When you left that job after a year, did you say, well, that's it for my career? Did you have that feeling?
I was embarrassed, for sure. It's embarrassing to be fired. I felt sad because I liked everybody that I worked with a lot. Like, everybody was genuinely really nice. And I think I felt relief to be free.
Uh-huh.
But mostly I felt relief because I felt like I'm so competitive in terms of trying to get things right. Or I used to be that way, more so than I am now, that I was like, I would have stayed there. I just would have stayed.
Right.
Just to try to make it right.
So better that the bad marriage ends quickly.
Yeah, I think so.
Your career didn't miss much of a beat looking back now at, you know, the last 5 years. And I wonder if you think it would have recovered as quickly as you did in a non-internet age. It seems like the web and all of that allowed you to, like, just get right back up and there be in everybody's faces and be funny.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I was so ready to be creative again when I left SNL just to exercise those creative muscles. I never expected that, like, when my husband and I made Marcel the Shell, that it would become a viral thing or whatever. I didn't think of it that way. But I was very happy to just be doing something that I could never explain. Like, if I went in to a television network and was like, I'd like to make a series about a male shell, but he's not like a sea animal, but he has a googly eye and then shoes.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just a documentary about nothing about him. They'd be like, this is a 0% idea.
Even in the age of 100 channels, that would be a hard pitch.
Hard sell. You gotta just do it.
This stop motion animated video you made, Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, was the first one. Became, as you say, this gigantic, gigantic viral hit. You now have a second children's book based on that character called Marcel the Shell, The Most Surprised I've Ever Been.
Yeah.
So it's a franchise for you. Can you read a little bit of that book sitting in front of you?
Sure. I'd love to.
Whatever bit makes sense to read.
I wrote this book with my husband, Dean Fleischer Camp, who also is the director and animator of the Marcel shorts, I should say, and also a cool person. He's a nice man.
One thing about a new day, you absolutely never know where it will go, even if you usually know where it starts. Usually in the morning, I get out of my bed and I start my day. I don't read the newspaper because it turns my shoes black, and I can't have coffee because one time I took a half a sip and I didn't blink for 5 hours. But that's not the surprise I wanted to tell you about. I wanted to tell you about the day I got the most surprised.
That's Jenny Slate reading from Marcel the Shell, The Most Surprised I've Ever Been, as Marcel.
Yeah.
Had you done that voice forever, or did that?
No.
Really?
I've never done it before. It's weird. It's weird. I don't know how it happened. I mean, I do know, like, when I started doing it over one weekend where I was packed into a motel room with, like, so many boys, and I just felt really small, and I started talking in that voice.
The books are lovely, the video's lovely, but the voice is a big part, don't you think, of why this has been successful?
I think so. I love the voice.
Yeah.
I'm not allowed to talk in it in our house, like, in some situations, and I talk in it too much sometimes.
Do you? Really? Just in real life?
Yeah, and sometimes I talk to myself in it, like, the other day, my friend, I was looking for something in my purse, and I was like,
oh, I'm never going to find it. Oh, God, there's too much garbage.
And he was like, is this what you do? You know, and it feels good to talk in it, and I don't know why I like it.
And does your husband like it, or does it just like, enough?
He likes it, but he doesn't like it when I do it to try to get out of doing stuff. like taking out the trash or like walking the dogs.
Being super cute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, uh-huh. I'm not allowed to do that. And I'm also obviously not allowed to do it during romantic times. But I would never do that.
You work with your husband productively, seemingly, and again and again. Is it hard to balance, to not only both be in show business, but to work together? Is that a difficulty?
Sometimes yeah. It's hard, but I do feel very creatively comfortable around him.
Between all this other work you've done, you made a web series with your husband called Catherine.
Yeah.
It's this very eerie kind of David Lynchian comedy consisting of these short 2 or 3 minute episodes, which is also – it's innocent, like a workplace mystery written by a child or something.
Yeah.
I want to play a clip from Catherine where you're returning to work at an office. And I should say in advance to listeners that it sounds like not much is happening. And Catherine is not a hugely plot-driven, action-packed thing. But the smallest exchanges have this great sense of dread.
Good morning, Catherine.
Hi, Samantha.
You don't have any pins yet, and you don't have any paper.
Right. Well, if it's like before, I'll need to use them.
It is like before. How many would you like of each?
May I please have 3 pens and 100 sheets of paper?
Sure. I have rubber bands if you want those.
No, thank you.
I'll go get the pens and the paper.
Thanks, Sam.
You're welcome.
That's Jenny Slate laughing at herself.
I love Catherine. I think it's the funniest thing I've ever done. I think it's so funny.
It is very funny. And it's perfect in a way for 2 or 3 minutes. It can be that weird and stylized because it only lasts 2 or 3 minutes. Do you know?
Yes. That's part of the joy of it. It really – like it started with my husband and I being really irritated at like Verizon commercials and stuff like that. That are like – the whole tone of them is like awkward, you know, like people looking to the side and being like – so, you know, and just, it's just, ugh, it's unbelievable. And we asked ourselves this question, like, what would it be like if everything was completely earnest and sincere and straightforward? And that, when we're not trying to do anything except for keep it totally neutral.
Right.
And it became like a game and we started to write it together and could tell when things were too much. You know, like when they're ordering lunch, if the sandwiches were too jokey, you know. But like sometimes the sandwiches are just right and they make you laugh so hard the more you think about them, like plain chicken with plain bread.
No, it's like the Truman Show of banality or something.
Yeah,
you know?
I really like it. I'm really proud of it.
So while you're trying to become a big star and be in bigger movies and be on TV, you do this just because you have enough hours in the day to exercise this other creative channel?
I guess it just becomes so important to make sure you do those things, especially in an industry that's very risk averse and where things can often be seen as a product before they're a piece of art. You know, I mean, not to like sound like a douche about it, but when I met Dean, what I loved about him right away and why I wanted him to stay forever was because I thought of a life together where we could just make stuff and just be living in that. In like a biodome of our creation and living with those expectations that we can just live with creative stuff around us.
And by the way, create this book. Well, yeah. Given all this stuff and you just want to do these things you want to do because they seem cool, do you have – I mean you've mentioned Gilda Radner and other actresses, actors as models. But do you have a career you look at and say, yeah, that one there, male or female, that looks pretty good to me, how that life went?
Hmm. I guess if I could have some sort of combination of like a really functional like Charles and Ray Eames situation.
I was thinking that myself.
With Dean and then be kind of like a Ruth Gordon type of person who's like a lady who's really, really old and still in complete possession of her creative choices and her sexuality.
And married to a director as well,
yeah.
Like Garson Kanin, you know? You could be the Eameses, you can be Ruth Gordon and Garson Kanin. You got it.
Yeah.
I grant you your wish.
Thank you so much. I never knew I was going to get it, but I didn't know when I came in here today this is what it would be, but yeah.
Jenny Slate, it has been a pleasure. I really enjoyed meeting you. Thanks.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
Jenny Slate's new book for kids, Marcel the Shell, The Most Surprised I've Ever Been, comes out this month. You can watch her in the movie Obvious Child and the FX show Married, which are both streaming online right now. And you can hear a longer version of our conversation at studio360.org.
Sing the cataracts of Sam's mom.
Singer-songwriter Tim Minchin is best known for his smart, edgy songs that have fun with subjects like God and destiny.
You only need to pray in a particular spot to a particular version of a particular God. And if you pull that off without a hitch, he will fix one eye of one middle-class white.
And now he's taken on a different kind of serious subject, childhood.
And when I grow up, I will leave. Sweets every day on the way to work, and I will go to bed late every night.
Minchin wrote the score for Matilda, the new musical that's now on Broadway. It's based on Roald Dahl's novel about this extraordinary girl trying to escape her dismal life. Tim Minchin is here with me now, sitting behind our Studio 360 grand piano. Tim Minchin, welcome.
Thank you, Kurt. Thank you for having me again.
So Matilda is nominated for 12 Tonys. In fact, 12 of the 14 categories in which it was possible to be nominated. Did you grow up reading Roald Dahl?
Yeah. Like, without a doubt, the predominant author of my childhood.
Really? Do you remember your first encounter with Matilda?
Well, Matilda came late. So Matilda was written in 88, by which stage I was in my early teens. And
But you read it.
But absolutely. I read it, yeah.
Well, then shortly after, you had this idea at age, some young age, 23, to, like, let's turn this into a show.
Yeah, I was writing music for children's theater. In my 20s, I wrote a lot of music for theater, mostly youth theater.
And in Australia.
Amateur stuff in Perth, yeah, in my hometown. And I had been writing for a children's theater company, and I just... At some point, I don't really remember the context of it, but at some point I thought, God, that's got to be a musical. Certainly when I went into a meeting with the director, Matthew Warchus, 10 years later, and he said, have you heard of Matilda? It felt like what fate would feel like if you believed in fate.
Yeah. Dahl is, among other things, one of the only children's book writers who kind of revels in kids being bad in the way kids sometimes are, people sometimes are. And Matilda makes the case for the necessity of sometimes breaking the rules, being bad, being naughty. Now that you have little children, do you still fully believe that idea?
I think my 6-year-old has a problem with this because Matilda says sometimes you have to be naughty. And my daughter says, why is it okay to be naughty? Because naughty really means bad to Violet, my 6-year-old, whereas I guess, you know, as you get a more sophisticated idea of naughty, it sort of means a bit cheeky or rebellious or whatever. But I have to explain to her that Matilda has no options but revenge early in the play. She has to do these little tricks and things to, because her parents are utterly awful.
And whereas Violet, you have this wonderful daddy and mommy.
You have perfect daddy. and she sort of understands that. But I think the thing about Dahl in most of his books, and the thing that we managed to perhaps capture, is that all the tools you need as a kid to free yourself are inherent in being a child.
Speaking of naughty, can you play it?
Sure, I'll play it for you. This is Matilda's first song.
Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water, so they say. The subsequent fall was inevitable. They never stood a chance, they were written that way. Innocent victims of their story. Like Romeo and Juliet, 'twas written in the stars before they even met. That love and fate and a touch of stupidity would rob them of their hope of living happily. The endings are often a little bit gory. I wonder why they didn't just change their story. We're told we have to do what we're told, but surely sometimes you have to be a little bit naughty. Just because you find that life's not fair, and doesn't mean that you just have to grin and bear it. If you always take it on the chin and wear it, nothing will change. Even if you're little, you can do a lot. You mustn't let a little thing like little stop you. If you sit around and let them get on top, you might as well be saying you think that it's okay. And that's not right. And if it's not right, you have to put it right. In the slip of a bolt, there's a tiny revolt. The seed of a war in the creak of a floorboard. A storm can begin with the flap of a wing. The tiniest mite packs the mightiest sting. Every day starts with the tick of a clock. All escapes start with the click of a lock. If you're stuck in your story and wanna get out, you don't have to cry, you don't have to shout. Cause if you're little, you can do a lot. You mustn't let a little thing like little stop you. If you sit around and let them get on top, you won't change a thing. Just because you find that life's not fair, it doesn't mean that you just have to grin and bear it. If you always take it on the chin and wear it, you might as well be saying you think that it's okay. And that's not right. And if it's not right, you have to put it right. And nobody else is gonna put it right for me. Nobody but me is gonna change my story. Sometimes you have to be a little bit naughty.
And that was Tim Minchin performing Naughty from his dozen Tony-nominated gigantic international boffo hit musical Matilda, now playing on Broadway.
It's a tiny little gigantic hit.
the London critics loved the show when it opened there. When you were getting ready to bring it to the United States, were there any serious worries about, will they get this? How do we translate this? What do we need to change? Did you change things?
Yeah, there's huge concerns about that because Broadway's a huge thing and you don't enter into that arena ill-prepared. And there was a lot of discussion about how we make sure American audiences got everything out of it.
Were there Britishisms? Because Matilda's parents, I mean, their awfulness is partly rooted in a certain kind of British class context that you could imagine, ooh, are they Americans going to get this?
Well, there's various layers of this. One is, I guess, the understanding of class and stuff. But as an Australian, I actually don't get that, nor really care. I don't think there's a crassness in the way they speak, which unfortunately does seem to tip its hat towards a particular socioeconomic group or something, but I don't think that's the point. The point is just that the rhythms are brassy, and American audiences know that there's other lexicons out there. They're happy to expand to that, but what you don't want to do is have their brains going sideways to some translation mode when they need to be concentrating on what's happening next. So there are moments when a child says, someone poured a whole can of treacle on, and so we changed it to syrup. And, you know, it's the jumper sweater thing. It's just all we changed were tiny things where we thought, they're going to be distracted by this. Let's make sure they're not.
When Matilda, the character, discovers her telekinetic powers, that she can make things float and fly, there's a moment when the song could have gone all Disney and cute. And
it did.
You think it did?
The first draft.
Really?
The first draft did. And it was exactly that. The brief was when she first feels this power, this amazing mind of her finally kind of almost spills out into the world and she tips over a cup initially. It's a very modest act of telekinesis. I was sort of thinking, well, how do we do this? What does she feel about this and where does it come from? So I wrote a piece that started with her trying to describe this bubbling and boiling and stuff, and that part of the song stayed there. But her conclusion of how she felt when it was done was a moment. The song was called Magical, and it was very, very wrong. It was one of those songs, even as I sat the director and the writers down and said, this is my draft, I knew it was wrong.
Huh.
And then went through this process. If she doesn't feel magical, does she feel huge? Imagine this tiny kid singing about feeling like a giant. Or imagine a tiny kid who has always felt too big for the space because her mind's so big, saying she finally feels small. Maybe there's a double irony there. And then I settled on the idea that it's peace that she achieves.
Can we hear that song?
Oh, yeah, all right. Have you ever wondered, well, I have, about how when I say red, for example, there's no way of knowing if red means the same thing in your head as red means in my head when someone says red, and how if we are traveling at almost the speed of light and we're holding a light, that light would still travel away from us at the full speed of light, which seems right in a way, but I'm trying to say I'm not sure, but I wonder if inside my head I'm not just a bit different from some of my friends. These answers that come into my mind unbidden, these stories delivered to me fully written, and when everyone shouts like they seem to like shouting, the noise in my head is incredibly loud, and I just wish they'd stop, my dad and my mum, and the telly and the stories would stop for just once. And I'm sorry, I'm not quite explaining it right, but this noise becomes anger, and the anger is light, and the burning inside me would usually fade, but it isn't today. And the heat and the shouting, and my heart is pounding, and my eyes are burning, and suddenly everything is. Quiet. Like silence, but not really silent. Just that nice sort of quiet, like the sound of a page being turned in a book, or a pause in a walk in the woods. Quiet. Like silence, but not really silent. Just that still sort of quiet, like the sound when you lie upside down in your bed, just the sound of your heart in your head. And though the people around me, their mouths are still moving, the words they are for me cannot reach me anymore. And it is quiet, and I am warm, like I've sailed into the eye of the storm.
Well done. That was Tim Minchin performing his song Quiet from the Broadway musical Matilda. One of my favorite songs in the show is called School Song, which weaves all the letters of the alphabet through the lyrics line by line in order. Now, how did you come to do that? Was that the idea of, oh, an alphabet song? And then you, like, doing the making a crossword puzzle, figured out how to do it?
Yeah, it's quite unromantic, actually, the origin of that. I stole the idea. So I had seen a cabaret show by an incredible songwriter friend of mine called Casey Bonetto in Melbourne, and he had written a love song called The ABC of Love that threaded the sounds of the letters into his lyrics. And I just rang him up and said, I think this is perfect. Can I steal this, or can I compensate you, or where did you get the idea? And he said, all he said was, there's no such thing as a new idea, Tim. And that was it. And Casey's one of the great humans on the planet. So, you know, I've thanked him in the program and in the songbook and stuff, but I always, whenever I have a chance to tell the story, I do, because it's a great idea and it works perfectly for this song.
Before you go, will you play us out?
Oh, sure.
Well, and in the theater, there are hundreds, maybe 1,000 people doing some audience interaction. We've conscripted a small audience so that listeners can get at least a sense of what happens. And so go ahead.
Yeah, right. So I've got everyone sitting around in the studio to yell out letters just so that the listeners can hear what's going on, because it is a bit weird. So I'll count you in, all right? Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Three. And so you think you're able to survive this mess by being a prince or a princess. You will soon see there's no escaping tragedy. And even if you put in heaps of effort, you're just wasting energy, 'cause your life as you know it is ancient history. I have suffered in this jail, have been trapped inside this cage for ages, this living hell. But if I try, I can remember back before my life had ended, before my happy days were over, before I first heard the pealing of the bell. Like you, I was curious, so innocent, I asked 1,000 questions. But unless you want to suffer, listen up and I will teach you a thing or two. You listen here, my dear, you'll be punished so severely if you step out of line, and if you cry it will be double. You should stay out of trouble and remember to be extremely careful.
Why?
Why? Why? Did you hear what he said? Just you wait for Phys Ed. Just you wait for Phys A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, V, W, X, Y. Just you wait for Phys Ed.
Tim Minchin, thank you very much.
It's in the bum problem.
Matilda the Musical is now on Broadway, and it was nominated for 12, count 'em, 12 Tony Awards. And you can see a video of Tim Minchin singing and playing our big grand piano here in Studio 360 at studio360.org.
Fazioli Manlio.
Long before Miley Cyrus decided to twerk all over the MTV Video Music Awards, Cole Porter perfectly captured the spirit of bawdy behavior and debauchery a la America.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now God knows.
We're always shocked until we're not anymore, until the next shocker comes around. But in the end, pretty much anything goes. As you might know, Anything Goes was the title song of a Cole Porter musical set aboard an ocean liner. The play is a little worse for wear, but the song keeps finding new fans thanks to covers, from Frank Sinatra to the cast of Glee. As part of our series on American icons, Studio 360's Eric Molinsky traces the history of a tune that celebrates breaking taboos.
You know, it's funny, the first time I heard Anything Goes was as a kid seeing Indiana Jones at the Temple of Doom.
Oh, in Chinese. And yeah. High Mandarin.
Yes. Do you remember that?
Apparently I do.
Will Friedwald is a pop music historian.
I'm sure there are people that have done it with a Latin rhythm. You could do it as a bossa nova. You could take it to Warsaw and do it as a polka. It would work perfectly as a polka. To me, that's the definition of a standard in the songbook, is that it's written to be done in all these different ways. You don't get to do that with a Beatles song or a Joni Mitchell song. Or if you do, usually the results are so vacacta, you know, why would you bother?
Vacacta is not a word that Cole Porter would have used. Unlike everyone else on Broadway, he didn't speak Yiddish.
99% of everybody else was Jewish and first or second generation immigrant and lived in New York.
Lawrence Maslin teaches theater at New York University.
Cole Porter seemed to have been airlifted from this mythical place called Peru, Indiana, with impeccable breeding and a stock portfolio worth several million dollars back in the 19-teens.
So, not exactly a starving artist. When his first Broadway show flopped in 1919, He moved to Paris and threw parties for years. That's actually how Porter established his great reputation as a songwriter, making up hilarious songs to play for his famous friends.
Richard Rodgers in 1926 made a pilgrimage to hear Cole Porter's songs because he couldn't imagine that they were as wonderful as he had heard, and they were even better.
They were also filled with double entendres. Porter waits until the end of the first verse of Let's Do It to reveal that doing it is just falling in love.
If you thought it was dirty in Cole Porter, you'd be right.
Paris in the 20s was perfect for Porter. Everyone knew he was gay, including his wife. Then the Depression hit, fascism was on the rise, the expat started going home. When Porter got back, he felt like Rip Van Winkle. He missed the roaring 20s, and when he was gone, America had gotten sexy. Historian Julia Foulkes says everyone was buzzing about this, quote, new American woman.
All of a sudden, she had short hair, she had a much shorter hemline, she was dancing, and she was smoking and drinking and going out with men, perhaps a number of men.
They were also voting and going to college and getting jobs in brand new skyscrapers. In the Depression, there were even laws passed to prevent women from taking work away from men.
And all of a sudden, you have that newfound freedom of women looking more threatening.
But the big change in social mores came from Detroit.
Prior to the 20th century, courtship would take place under the guise and under the eyes of your family. So you'd be sitting on the porch, swinging perhaps with your intended. And it was all very scripted in many ways and very watched. But cars came around and it allowed for private space. And a lot more things could occur in the backseat of a car than on a park bench or a dance hall.
So Porter's observing all these changes while he's plotting his comeback. He has a couple of modest hits, and then in 1934, he strikes gold with Anything Goes. The show is full of madcap shenanigans on a cruise ship. The plot is vapid, but the songs are catchy. It was a perfect tonic for the Depression. Porter even cut a demo that played on the radio.
Times have changed, and we've often rewound the clock. Since the Puritans got the shock when they landed on Plymouth Rock. If today any shock they should try to stem, instead of landing on Plymouth Rock, Plymouth Rock would land on them. In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now God knows anything goes.
Now, we usually think of the 60s as the big era of social change, but the 1920s were a shocker. Porter is writing about lesbian fashionistas, respectable writers using four-letter words, and couples going to nudist parties. There are also jokes about Rockefeller, Roosevelt, and scandals from the 30s that no one remembers now. But we're still humming the tune. What makes the song endure, according to Lawrence Maslin, is the opening verse, which ties it all back to the Puritans.
We have something called the First Amendment that says that we can say whatever we want and implicitly we can do most of what we want. And yet there's this Puritan streak in America which says, oh, you can't change, you can't do that, that offends me.
The character singing the song is ambivalent about slipping standards, but Porter himself didn't feel that way.
I think what Cole Porter says is you better accept the fact that anything's going to go because that's what America's about, and you might as well enjoy the ride because American society is not going to stop for you, and it's not going to go backwards.
If it were serious, if it was really saying, oh, things are changing and we got to stop it, then it wouldn't hold up. You know, the mere fact that the camp element is there is the very thing that allows the lyric to be timeless.
Will Friedwald is an expert on the Great American Songbook, but in 1934 there was no Great American Songbook. The shelf life of a Broadway tune was short. By the 1950s, Anything Goes was a relic. And by coincidence, so was Frank Sinatra. It's hard to remember now, but Frankie used to be a teenage heartthrob. And when the screaming girls in Bobby Socks outgrew him, he was all washed up. In 1953, Sinatra reinvented his career and popular music itself with a series of albums that made Cole Porter and other songwriters from that era sound fresh again.
Sinatra is really the one who says that these songs are classics, and this is what America has brought to the world. This is one of our great gifts to world culture, and that these songs deserve to be preserved and revered the same way that Bach is revered, the same way that Beethoven is revered.
The world has gone mad today, and good's bad today, and black's white today, and day's night today, when most guys today that women prize today are just silly gigolos.
Sinatra's Anything Goes was so popular, it led to a TV broadcast of the show starring him and Ethel Merman. Paramount remade the movie in 1956, and a few years later, Anything Goes was back on Broadway.
Anything goes.
When you hear somebody say, such and such a song was neglected, or such a song is rare, or underdone, generally, the unspoken criteria of a song being underdone means that it was never done by Sinatra or Ella Fitzgerald.
So though I'm not the great romancer, I know that I'm bound to answer when you propose.
Anything Goes sort of worked for the atomic cocktail age, but the lyrics about Mae West and the Vanderbilts had to go. Even the lines about fast cars and short skirts were starting to feel quaint. Now, if you hear Anything Goes, it's part of a retro Rat Pack album with Michael Bublé or Harry Connick Jr. We've lost that sense of danger, the titillation that audiences felt back in 1934. What would Anything Goes sound like if it were written today?
Hi, Joe.
Hey, Eric.
How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Joe Keenan has written for TV shows like Frasier and Desperate Housewives. He's also a songwriter. He creates these great parodies of Cole Porter songs as a favor for charity events.
It takes a certain talent to, you know, to ape Porter's songs, but it took genius to come up with the template in the first place.
So we gave Joe the task of updating Anything Goes. A reboot, as they say in Hollywood. So
I thought, well, what's the way in? I could just write, you know, updated stanzas, but do a lot of updated stuff seemed to me to lack a point of view, and I thought it would be more interesting to approach the song by saying, you know, if Porter wrote that song today, what would be Porter's take, and what would he find a little bit shocking? And that wasn't an easy question to answer, because Porter was such a sophisticate that, you know, very little would have surprised him.
But when Joe started brainstorming, he found plenty of stuff. One generation's idea of slipping standards is another generation's idea of liberation from social constraints. And that's the story of America. So here is Joe Keenan's update of Anything Goes, sung by his good friend Brian Batt, who played the character Sal Romano on Mad Men. A quick word of warning. These lyrics are not G-rated. So if there are kids listening, heads up, because anything goes.
Times have changed. Porter's ditty was once risque. But if Porter could see today and decorum's complete decay, would say, though the 30s were hot as hell, everything that went then still goes, and a whole lot else as well. When gays can wed and jaws aren't dropping, when Barney and Ben go shopping for baby clothes, anything goes. When dames as dim as Kim Kardashian triumph by acting trashy in tawdry shows, anything goes. The smut you can get today on the net today, straight or gay today and all day today, 'cause burlesque today is on your desk today, where nobody can oppose. When girls of 10 are adolescing and proving the fact by dressing like tiny hoes, anything goes. When grandma's face is pulled so tightly she looks like a Keira Knightley whose eyes won't close, anything goes. When stars whose thoughts are far from clever are tweeting their fans whenever they blow their nose, anything goes. If airing your views you like on Fox News you like, if tattoos you like or girl's shoes you like, if rendezvous you like with Tom Cruise you like, just say you won't disclose. When Cary Grants and Spencer Tracy's have turned into Kevin Spacey's and Russell Crowe's, anything goes. When fast food chains serve fries with bacon to folks who could be mistaken for buffaloes, anything goes. When half the nation's filled with rancor from living in homes their banker will soon foreclose,
anything goes. Though banks are all crooks today with cooked books today, when they fail today, they get bailed today. And those banks today are saying thanks today as their bonus pool just grows. When men of God who preach with thunder are looking for fun with underage Romeos, anything goes. Anything, anything. Everything goes.
That was the Studio 360 reboot of Cole Porter's Anything Goes, written by Joe Keenan. Brian Batt performed it with Jesse Reeks on piano. You can find the lyrics and download the song if you want at studio360.org. And Studio 360's Eric Malinsky produced our story. The new American Icon season continues through the fall. We'll be bringing you 9 new icons in all, and we want you to pick the 10th. What novel or movie, song, play, building, or other piece of American culture do you think deserves the spotlight? Visit studio360.org/American Icons and click on the map to let us know.
Now, from the heights of modern drama, we descend, as it were, to the depths of popular fiction. A boy, the infant son of English aristocracy, is orphaned in the West African jungle. He is adopted by a species of ape, unknown to science, and comes to think of himself as one of their kind, growing into a fine example of noble savage. This is the premise of a novel published recently by Mr. Edgar Rice Burroughs. Its title? Tarzan of the Apes. The book details the young ape man's encounter with another human, the beautiful Jane, and his reactions to civilized life. For today's program, we've asked Mr. Jack Handy, the popular humorist and author of Deep Thoughts, to imagine Tarzan's adventures in the United States of the future.
Tarzan in the Village by Jack Handy. This Tarzan. Tarzan, speak now. Listen, Tarzan. Many year ago, Tarzan, Jane have marital difficulty. Jane say Tarzan not care about Jane feeling. Tarzan say, what about Tarzan feeling? Jane leave, go across great ocean to big city. Tarzan follow. Jane file restraining order Tarzan. Tarzan get apartment Greenwich Village, McDougal Street, between Bleecker, West 3rd, 5th story climb up. Tarzan get job chemical bank. Boss say like Tarzan attitude. Maybe make Tarzan comptroller. That crazy time Tarzan life. Tarzan take many drug. Uppers, downers.
Acid.
Mary Jane.
Purple haze.
Black beauties.
Chinese doorbells.
You name it, Tarzan take it. Many time Tarzan wake up strange apartment. Wonder how Tarzan get there. Tarzan ask Tarzan, how Tarzan get here? Tarzan answer, Tarzan not know. Tarzan get fired from chemical bank because high all time. Seem ironic to Tarzan, lose job at chemical bank because take chemicals. Boss not understand irony, even after Tarzan explained him. Tarzan think everyone square, write poetry. Here sample Tarzan poetry. Hey, Mr. Business, go back in hole where come from. Stay there, like aardvark. Tarzan lose all sense reality. One time stare at single spot on leopard skin for whole day. Other time Tarzan try see Bob Dylan in Village Club, wind up going see Phyllis Diller.
My body's in such bad shape, I wear prescription underwear.
Not notice difference. That how messed up Tarzan. Low point come when Tarzan climb tree in park. Do Tarzan yell for tourist, get money for drug. Tourist say, you not real Tarzan. Tarzan think, me wish not real Tarzan. Tarzan go back apartment, get big surprise. Jane there. Also boy, also cheetah, Also Mr. Kim, owner of Bodega on Corner. What going on? Then Tarzan realized, this intervention. Tarzan get clean, sober. Tarzan Jane go back jungle. Boy Cheetah go back Harvard. Tarzan stay straight, not even eat hyena berries. Kids, listen Tarzan, no take drugs. Tarzan lucky, drugs not hurt Tarzan brain. Maybe you not so lucky.
Tarzan in the Village, created for Studio 360 by Jack Handy. Mr. Handy's recent novel, also a book of exotic adventures, is entitled The Stench of Honolulu. Music and sounds for our story were arranged by Miss Jill DeBoff.
This is Sideshow, a podcast from Studio 360. I'm Sean Ramosferum. Think of a comedian. Think of your favorite bit that he or she does. Now try and think of your second favorite bit that he or she does. You can probably do this if you thought of any comedian but Howard Kramer. More than any comedian I can think of, Howard has dedicated his life to just one joke. Summer. I saw Howard do his summer bit in Los Angeles a few years ago.
This is a great time of year. Summer is just getting started. It's just starting to rev up. Can you guys feel it?
Yeah!
At first, he's just kind of spinning wheels about summer, and no one's really laughing, which, at a comedy club, is a pretty bad sign.
You gotta smell the summer, right? Who could smell the summer? The suntan lotions. The ocean breeze.
Then Howard starts doing this adversarial thing with his audience, and it starts to get a lot funnier because no one's actually challenging him.
What's that? You're not gonna have a summer? Why? Because there's risks. What's that? You're not gonna have a summer? Why? Sharks. Think it through, it's not so bad. You're out there in the water, you're splashing around, getting wet. All of a sudden you feel a pinch on your leg. So what do? You look up at God, you thank him for all the summers that he's given you. And you fade away. Congratulations, you just died a glorious summer death.
Howard goes on about summer for another few minutes, and at the end of the bit, he awkwardly reaches into his pocket to pull out a piece of paper, presumably with his notes for the set.
All right. All this paper says is have a summer.
The bit's good. It's not here's your own sitcom good, but it's original and charming in its own way. But Howard has built an empire on summer.
Have a summer hotline.
Zooey Deschanel co-starred with him in a Have a Summer short for Funny or Die. He has released 3 albums of summer songs, and he hosts an annual festival in Los Angeles called Summerfest, of course. It's got water slides, food trucks, and rappers. Howard has other jokes, but summer is his brand. It's his life. He's got a summer food.
A tasty summer salad.
He's got a summer gum.
Trident Tropical Twist. Tri-Trop Twiz.
And he definitely has a summer song.
There's a song by the Beach Boys called Catch a Wave, which is like...
Catch a wave and you're sitting on top of the world.
Don't be afraid to try the greatest. How often do people ask you, like, yo, why are you obsessed with summer?
I guess for all that I talk about it, then some people don't get it and they go, what's that about? And well, to me, it's just like when you used to be a kid, you used to work all, you know, school year and then you got a break. And then I remember finding out, I don't know, when I was 10 or probably earlier, but like, oh, when you're adult, you don't get to do that. You just got to keep going to your job. And I just thought that was a bad thing. Like, oh, like why do I want to get older then? It just seemed terrible not to have a summer. And then I think people like work through them. And then so many of my friends and for me the same way, it was like, you don't really consider June to be summer because it's not like officially summer. So then it's like you don't go swimming until like 4th of July. Then another couple weeks goes by and it's August, sort of. And you just haven't had a summer. And then it just struck me over the years. It's like, oh, I missed summer again. Like, how did that happen? And then, you know, in like, I think it was 2009, I was feeling like, oh, it was summer. And I was like, I got to work. I got to get some stuff done. And then I was like, no, I got to go to the beach. And I was like, no, I got to get some stuff done. I got to get to work in here. And then I was like, no, I got to get to the beach. And then I went to the beach. And even at the beach, I was like, what are you doing here? You got to get some work done. And then I was like, no, you got to have a summer. And then I was just like, that's it. I was like, there it is. That's the crux of the debate. I'm going to choose summer, and I'm going to tell people about it.
For the rest of your life, or is this just like an experiment?
No, it's rest of my life. Like, I think it's just a better way to live, kind of. It's like cycles, you know what I mean? It's like life goes in cycles, and I just like having that. I like having that one time a year that you really just – that it's the best time of year, so you stop what you're doing and you celebrate it.
And in 2009, when you went to the beach and were so conflicted and at odds with all of your goals, were you living in Los Angeles?
Yes, I was. I went to Austin first. I lived there for like 7.5 years, but I always knew that I was going to come here.
Yeah, it's always summer in Austin too, but not so much like beach.
Oh, God. You cannot get people excited about summer in Texas. I've tried.
Is that right?
I mean, they like, it's so hot. Like, summer is their winter. Like, that's when weather is oppressive and you just stay inside.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I remember going down there once. I think it was like in August. So it had been like over 100 degrees for like 4 months. And then I went in there, have a summer.
Did you bomb?
I mean, they didn't buy into it. Let's put it that way. I don't know if I bombed, but they didn't buy into it at all.
So where did you grow up?
Oh, I grew up in New Jersey.
Okay.
You know, like 20 minutes from the beach, central New Jersey. So we used to go to like Asbury Park and Bradley Beach and Belmar and those places.
Huh.
And I just loved it. And then I remember like you get a little older, you hear people say they hate the beach, and the Dead Milkmen was this band, and they had a song about hating the beach, and I was just like, what?
I don't want to be on the beach, no fun! I don't want to be on the beach, no fun! I don't want to be on the beach, I don't want to be on the beach, no fun, no!
It took me a while to realize they weren't kidding. I don't know. I just always loved it down there. That's where we come from. We we originally lived in the water. So to me, that's probably why we feel at home there.
Yeah.
So,
do you think had you not grown up in like a place that was cold for much of the year, you would still feel the same way you do about having a summer?
Yeah, that was a problem when I was a kid because I was like, you wait for summer and then when it comes, like the water's still cold on the East Coast and then like a lot of the days the weather's not even nice. So yeah, maybe that like that summer shortage made me appreciate it even more.
And of course, you've turned that appreciation into a music career, right? In 2012, you released an album called Have a Summer, which is your catchphrase, I guess.
Yep, that was the first one.
I'm going to play a song called What's That, Huh? You're Not Going to Have a Summer?
What's that, huh? What's that, huh? You're not going to have a summer? Why, how come? Because there's risks. Sure, there's risks. So what? You've got to overcome it. You're out on the boardwalk, walking barefoot. How'd you catch a splinter right in your hook? Stop in your tracks, you let out a yell. What do you do? It hurts like hell. You hop to the bar next to the arcade. You do a shot of tequila to ease the pain. Then you head next door to the bowling alley. They sterilize your wound with that bowling juice play. Okay, what's that?
Oh my God.
What's that?
Thank you. Wow, I haven't heard that one in a while. That's a deep cut, and I want to thank you for playing it. That song doesn't always get into the rotation.
When did you decide to make music dedicated to this theme?
I guess, as soon as I get a comedy idea, for some reason my brain tries to turn it into a song. Because I've been writing songs since I was young.
Uh-huh.
So it was the same thing with Have a Summer. As soon as I thought of it, then my brain starts going, oh, you could do this song. You could do a song about this. You could do a song about this. And then there were so many songs kind of so quickly that I thought, okay, I got to record this.
How are sales?
Oh, it's been great. I mean, for something that's not like you know, promoted by a major label or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's been like kind of the classic, you know, DIY kind of thing where each one sells more than the last one, and people like really embrace the philosophy of it, and like people teach it to their kids and send me pictures of their kids and stuff. So it's like,
wait, what are the pictures you get of people's kids?
Like they'll be wearing the Have a Summer T-shirt, okay. or like a teacher will say, I told my students, you know, to write about what they're going to do this summer. So it's like a classroom full of kids and their stuff and their pictures that they drew. So like you always want to like do something that catches the public's imagination, because I've done tons of other ideas that nobody likes or gets, you know, along with other good ones. But when you have one that like, it catches on, and it like it's hard with stand up to convey raw emotion and still be funny, but with Have a Summer it's like it's a meaningful thing, but it still has humor in it. So I'm real happy that people like it.
And I guess that's why you've had to expand on this idea of having a summer, right?
Yeah.
On your latest album, Some of This, Some of That, you got a song called Gay for Poseidon.
That's right.
La la la, he's tickling my ankles, he's tickling my knees.
Yeah, basically, you know, the ocean is a man, Poseidon, and if that's true, then I'm gay for Poseidon. I love being inside him, and it's fantastic.
Let us be who we may, dead. La la la, my girl is with me here at the water's edge.
Ooh,
la la la, Poseidon don't care, he's doing stuff to my leg. Poseidon, I like him, he likes me, we're happy as can be, let us be who we be. Let's all head down to the shore for a ceremony, for this land has passed the law, we men can marry the sea.
Amazing.
Thanks.
Has Poseidon gotten back to you?
You know, I go see him every now and then. He's happy to see me. He's always nice. No, people have been sending me pictures of Poseidon statues and stuff. So it is fun to like put in those new wrinkles and stuff and see you know, how people react.
Do you play these songs live?
I'm starting to now. I'm starting to work on that now because I want to do a tour where I do all the songs and stuff like that. So it's kind of been this weird thing, like you know, the Beatles for a while didn't, you know, they just were a recording act. They didn't tour.
Yeah.
So I took the inspiration and just that's what I was doing with it for a while. But now I think it's time to take it live.
You're friends with lots of comics, right?
Oh, yeah.
Do they ever give you a hard time for sort of like maybe milking a bit for so many years?
They like a lot of times when people see me, they just go like Have a Summer or something like that. I mean, there may be that sentiment out there, but no one's ever said that to me. It comes from like a place of just trying to have fun and be silly. I mean, it's not. I mean, I still do stand up and I still do regular stand up and I have for a long time. So I think people just look at it as like an offshoot.
Uh-huh.
I think people are cool about it, or if they talk shit about it, they don't do it in front of me, because you got to have a summer. I'll just tell them to have a summer and I'll win.
Summer's almost over. It went so fast. Now the end's inside. But I'm not so down about it this time, because I did summer right.
You think in 30 years you'll still be singing about summer?
God, you know, I hope so. Part of this was like a backwards engineering thing. I'm like, where do I want to wind up? And then I was like, that wouldn't be bad if you could just like be at the beach singing songs for people. So if that's where all this winds up, then I guess that's what I asked for. I hope it's great.
I've got bad news.
You're a winter guy?
No.
Oh.
My summer's coming to an end.
Were you in Australia?
No, I'm in New York.
Oh.
I just mean Labor Day's here and it's going to be fall soon.
Okay, there you. That's the whole point of this. It's like it goes so fast, and people don't start it on time, and the government has moved in and chopped it up. School starts now, like it's August 15th. You have to kind of remind yourself. I went to the beach with a friend like a week and a half ago, and he goes, "This is great. I should have been doing this all summer." And I'm like, "Oh," I go, "if only there was a guy that reminded everybody to have a summer."